What about in terms of any kind of social consciousness from your grandparents or your parents, let alone political? I assume that they were just upstanding members of the community and the public eye and involved in the church.
But political?
Did you have any political consciousness or any political ideologies?
Yeah.
That
Well, are we talking about political ideas or political participation?
Both.
They had a lot of clout in the Democratic Party. Before that, my grandfather was sort of a maverick. This is the intelligent grandfather that I never saw. He was a backer of the Greenback Party, and there was another minority party, National, and in 11, I think, or 13, I don't know about those dates, a socialist mayor was elected in Flint, Michigan. And he and one of my uncles was very instrumental in that. And, of course, he was considered as a maverick, my grandfather, but because of his standing Captain Jarve and so on, they accepted it. And I believe that they were a little more tolerant, you know. There wasn't this business of anarchists and reds and so on that came in later when it became a threat to the corporations, because there were no big corporations at that particular time. And so they did elect a socialist mayor. I don't know too much about the period except that my father thought that was a very ridiculous thing as he grew older. You know, the Democratic Party should have been the only party that, you know. Now, in political ideas, my father was exceedingly conservative. He was a racist. He was a chauvinist, a male chauvinist, and he felt that the Southerners were inferior to the Northerners. All ethnic groupings were inferior to the English, you know, background. My God, when you boiled it down, you know, there was nobody except the people who lived in his house, yes, that were worthy of being...
Some of them were women.
Yeah, that's right. He was a very, very ignorant, stupid man, and his ideas always appalled me. And one of the things that he used to do that my mother used to think was very bad, and she'd come home and talk to us privately after, he would take us for rides on Sunday. He was one of the people, of course, that was early to have a car, an automobile in Flint. And people used to come and look at his car. They used to shine it up and put it up on bricks. Can you imagine? So the rubber wouldn't get worn out. And he'd take us for rides, and he'd say, "No, I'm going to take you to... the section of the city that's the dangerous section. I'm going to take you up into Niggertown. Now, you better get down on the floor of the car and just peek over, because if you look at them wrong, they may rush out and stab you." Well, my heavens, our hearts were up in our mouths, you know, at first. And then my mother would take me home and say, "Don't you believe that? There are always good people. It doesn't matter what color," and so on. And there were only a few times that this happened, but it was a traumatic incident, you know, and then my mother's lecture afterward. So I grew very, and then whenever he would talk about the dollar was the almighty God. This is the only friend you'll ever have. Remember that, this dollar bill. And when you're down and out, the people who call themselves friends now, you won't see them, you know. Remember, this is your best friend. And my mother used to say, "Don't believe that, you know, this is a very empty philosophy to have."
But she was always counteracting him.
In a quiet way. She never wanted to argue with him openly. And she would say a few words like, "Oh, now, Ray, you know, that isn't true. Now, don't tell the children that." But she would always take us off on the side and say, "Don't believe this." You know, she didn't want to have any arguments or confrontations. So I was going to tell you about this maternal grandfather of mine. My maternal grandfather was able to take care of children. He loved children. And even at a very old age, in his 80s, he would come to visit us in Flint. And all the kids in the neighborhood would know that Grandpa was in town, because he carried little white, red and white peppermints in his pocket. And he walked down the street and always give them a little peppermint. And they'd have like a Pied Piper, a whole gang of kids following him. And this grandfather and one of his sons, an uncle of mine, who also loved babies and would rock them and take care of them, and they didn't care what other men, there was no stigma as far as they were concerned, you know, they wouldn't accept the criticisms of other men. They became my ideals of what a man should be. kind and warm and affectionate and never macho, you know. And they became my ideals of what a man should be. And then when I met Carl Johnson, who became my father-in-law, this was another man, an intellectual and one who liked children. He didn't administer to children only because his wife thought that was her preserve. And she was a matriarch, a different type of matriarch. But he was...
There were other models of men that
yes.
were available to you, so that the father
yes.
was not the only image you had.
Yes, although my father had a very strong influence on me because I was a very aggressive female as a result of, you know, always having to prove. I ran into more prototypes, more men like my father than I did like my grandfather and uncle were an exception in those days. In fact, my father used to call them sissies, and they're poor excuses for men, you know. And the majority of men were more like my father.
Did the family do things together? You talked about going out on rides on Sundays, because there seemed to be a lot of conflict within the family.
No. I can remember once we went to Niagara Falls, and a couple of times we went to a big lake in Three Rivers, Michigan on vacation, but my father never wanted to take the kids with him. He was resentful of the kids in many respects. He wanted the attention of my mother solely, and whenever he wanted to go someplace, he wanted to go with her and leave the kids at home. Yeah.
How about with your mother then? Did you do things with her, or your relationship was mainly within the home?
Within the home. Mm-hmm. She didn't go out very much, like most, but she didn't drive. Women weren't supposed to drive, and she wasn't going to cause any arguments. One time she screwed up her courage and wanted to drive, and my father took her out several times during this period, and she came home a nervous wreck each time. She said, I have to get a professional person to teach me, but apparently she never got around to do that.
Now, what you started talking about, your mother... training you to be a cultured young girl with the dancing and the music, etc. But did she have any aspirations for you in terms of having a career or educating yourself more beyond public schools and high school?
Oh, yes. Yes, she did. Because I was always on the honor roll in school. And she used to think that I was very bright. She used to say she thought that I had more talents than my brother in the academic field. Yes, she wanted me to go on to college. She wanted me to do everything that I possibly could do. And she always encouraged me. Now, my father, on the other hand, when I was growing up, wanted me at a certain age, I became, well, I think very early, a tomboy. This was to prove to my father I could do anything that my brother could do or any other boy. And I used to climb garages, and I used to play baseball, and I became the best pitcher on a softball team, better than any of the boys, and my father was having fits. He bought my brother a bike. He would not buy me one because I was supposed to be a little lady, and girls weren't supposed to ride bikes, and I was very resentful of this. My mother used to wear what they call bloomers, little rubber things, father used to say, have you been up on the garages? Let me see your bloomers. And my mother, after school, would say, put these black bloomers. You know? I used to climb and do all the things that the boys used to do. And he was so resentful because I was supposed to be a little lady and embroidery and sew and sit down and be quiet. My mother was much more understanding in that respect. One time, when I was about in the fifth grade, we had, or sixth grade, and turn this. I know what I was telling you about because I read it in this book that just came out, this woman published. When I was in the fifth or sixth grade, we had to have electives whether to take, the boys could take art shop or woodwork, wood shop, and girls could take cooking or sewing. And so they came to me and asked me which did I choose. And I said I wanted auto shop. And they said, oh, you know that girls can't go to something like that. I said, why not? It's a very practical thing to know. Well, I'm sorry, the answer is no. And I said, all right, I'll take woodchop. And the same thing again. So I was very put out because I had no interest in sewing or cooking. That was just the thing that every girl had forced on. And I didn't want to take them. So I talked to some of the other girls. We were very young then. And we went home. And the next day when we came back to school, we came in dungaree pants, which was a very unusual thing. Girls did not wear pants of any kind to school then. And I had blue shirts. I think we had brothers. I'm not sure where we got those pants from, whether we had brothers or what. Maybe I had a pair of pants. And we pinned boys' names on the back of our shirts. And I Charlie and Bob and so on. And we had them printed, great big signs like that, and pinned them right on the back strip, and we walked around school like that until we got caught. And, oh, I'm telling you, they had a big deal about that. Today it wouldn't be, nobody think anything of it. But they called the parents of these girls up to school, and, of course, the girls got frightened, and whose idea was it was mine. And they were all warned, never do that again, and the parents were all shocked. And then my parents came up there, and they sent me out of the room. They told my parents they better watch me, with such tendencies as that. I guess they thought I was going to turn into a lesbian right in front of them or something. And so for a long while, my father was kind of, quizzical. He didn't know what kind of a daughter he was raising. But any girl could do that in school.
This, you would be about 10 or so.
Yes. Yeah.
How many other girls did this with you?
Four, I think. I think we were five in all. Mm-hmm. And of course, those poor little girls got so frightened, with this great big conference, principals, teachers, parents, everybody else, the whole world coming down on them. They got very frightened, and I was still quite rebellious. I thought they were a bunch of stupid people who were just trying to keep little girls from learning something practical.
Did you talk the other girls into it?
Oh, yes. Yes, I talked to the other girls into it. I don't think little girls had very many ideas like that, at that time. It's entirely different.
Who were most of your companions at that age, Janora?
Who were most of them? Let's see. I can remember their names, if that was your name. Let's see. They were middle-class girls, white, because that was the school I was in. There was only one girl, Clara Johnson was her name, too, whose mother and father were very old, and they had been there all their lives in the community, and they had a little house, white wood house, and they had a little yard in the back with chickens and things like that going down a little hill, and they had very old-fashioned furniture, and they didn't have lovely new modern things like my father had. And I loved that woman, I loved that family, I loved that little backyard, and I always wanted to go over to Clara's house. And Father thought that that was beneath our family status, he didn't like me over there. And I used to remind them that they were very, very upright people, religious and everything else, this little old mother and father of Clara's. And that didn't make any difference, that wasn't in our class. That was the only one that I can remember that was without affluent, wasn't a fluent family.
But most of these were children who lived in your own neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And what about the church community? Was that very much within your neighborhood too, or did that grow?
No, that grew, in our circle. And that would be the center of town. All of the people then were mainly around, Detroit Street Court. So it was around in the center of town then.
Then in junior high school and high school is when you were exposed to children from other classes and other ethnicities.
Yeah, then not very much. I went to the central school in the center of town, the high school and the junior high school also. Just to show you, before the factories became big corporate enterprises and big influxes of people moved in, the principal of my school, who had called this conference, was a lady by the name of Mary Kelly, Miss Mary Kelly, an old woman with white hair. She had been the teacher of my father, And later on, after these little boys went to school, they went to that same school to the same principal. So Mary Kelly, when she talked to my father, I can remember he got expelled from school for putting Limburger cheese on the soap pipe. I guess, or at least was he expelled? Yeah, he was expelled. And she remembered that. She said, you know, your sins are coming back to visit you. Okay.
Well, when you were in grade school and Princess did something like that, of coming in with the clothes and the boy's name, did you get any support at all from any of the teachers, or was it uniformly looked upon as being something
queer? It was something a bit queer. The only reason that there wasn't more reprisals is because I was the top honor student in the school, and the teachers liked me as a student. Now, I can remember another act of rebellion one time. Kids were not supposed to chew gum. And if they did, we had one old, this is brilliant, and one old witch of a teacher. She was really one that believed in physical punishment. You held out your hand and she'd whack it with a ruler, you know, very, very hard. And one of the kids was caught chewing gum in the class, and it was a boy, and he didn't want to cry, but it hurt him. And he, you know, the tears, and then kids kind of titted a little bit, you know. And I was so put out at this indecent act, you know, that I borrowed a stick of gum and put it in my mouth, and I chewed it real hard, and she didn't want to see me, but I think she knew what I was doing it for. And I just chunked it so hard that she had to look at me, and then she called me up in front, and I put my hand out, and I turned around, and I just they had the straightest face. In fact, I may even have smiled, and she really laid it on. But I was not going to let that kid become, you know, the center of attraction and be humiliated like that all alone. So I went up there, and I wouldn't cry. I wouldn't do anything. She was trying to make an example of me. But I guess I was empathizing with that kid.
Next. Any teachers when you were in grade school, though, who you looked up to and were sort of models for you? Very often with many women, it seems to be where they had a vision of what a woman could be outside the home.
Mm-hmm.
The teacher.
There was one in the first grade, I think, because of her charm and her culture, and she was a very peaceful type of person, but was able to work with kids that I admired very, very much. And I think probably is because she was a lot like my mother. And secondly, she represented anything but violence and braggadocio and the other things represented by my father. I think probably she would be the only one in the elementary. In the high school, there was a drama teacher because I was in drama. I was in ballet and I was in a cappella choir, a drama teacher who I looked up to. We were putting on plays. I was Joe in Little Women, and we were doing Shakespeare and things like that. And, of course, I liked that very much at the time. Teachers. And one thinks of a teacher who taught early Egyptian history and why I was so attracted to that woman. Oh, yes, because she was not at all attracted to men, you know, and on a couple of occasions she'd say, who needs it? I have a full life. I love teaching and so on. Yes, she was the person that I respected highly. Respected her. Only one thing I couldn't quite understand, she never had a hair out of place. And I like tousled hair and I like natural living. But I respected that woman very, very much. And an art teacher who never got married, Miss Catherine Law. Oh, my God. She was beautiful. She was a tyrant when it came to art. She wanted to give you that, you know, she wanted to develop any talent that you had. And she also had my father as a she was a teacher to my father. And when I went to transfer from the junior high art class into the new high school that had been built, and all of my friends were going over there, I had to transfer from art to taking typing. And I wanted to go with the kids badly enough that I wanted to give up the art. And she called my father down there and she rigged a riot act to him. Your daughter's got talent. What are you permitting this for? And he was a very unpredictable guy. He said, maybe she doesn't like your domination. She's a chip off the old block. She wants to go over there, she can go over there. And he's always making the decisions that were the wrong ones for me. You know, he's going to try to persuade me to stay in art because I really loved art, and I did have a natural talent for it. But always he was making the wrong decisions. When I got married, the same thing. Come home and tear the telephone box out of the wall and tell me he's going to have this poor guy prosecuted under the Mann Act. Went down to see an attorney, locked me in my Christ, all the things that you don't do, you know, to a person. And if he had ever sat down, or my mother was able to do anything with him, I was frightened to death, you know. Well, this was a very permanent step that I had taken. You know, you've gotten married and put your name down legally and all of this. I was a very frightened person. And we were living back at our own homes. You know, I just went home. I couldn't even make the thing seem real. And this father doing this, which just made me, you know, again, no man is going to dominate me like that.
Well, let's backtrack a little bit to your earlier days in high school. Then that's when you would have come, because you said that Kermit and his father, who were both auto workers, were teaching in the working class. So once you got to high school then, you were beginning to meet and associate with children from other classes.
Yes. But primarily they were still my same group that came from elementary, junior high, over to high school, same group of friends that I had. Now, when I got into high school, there was a sorority and a fraternity, and I was eligible from all of my friends that I went around with. I was eligible for the sorority, and both the fraternity boys and the sorority girls were trying to have me accepted, have me apply and be accepted and so on. And I could not see this. I couldn't see this kind of discrimination against all the others who were not eligible. And so I refused to join. And the boys would come up and say, look, we can take you to this affair and that one. And I'm sorry, but I can't, I just can't see that kind of discrimination. I never joined the sorority, and nor was I talked into going out with any of those fraternity boys. I didn't like that either.
Did your parents put pressure on you to join?
I never took that question home. I made my own decision. I didn't give a damn what anybody thought. I thought it was unjust. And one of the boys had a car. A couple of the fraternity boys had cars or had accesses to them. And it was a big thing for girls to go in the rumble seat of a car, you know, or these sports cars. And, I went out with Phil, whatever his name's car, and he took me for a ride. And I thought it was so ridiculous, the whole bit, by this time. But I can't remember, outside of Kermit and Kermit's friends. Now, he came from another part of town, working class section. And when I met him and his friends, they did come from an entirely different working class. In school, yeah. No, he wasn't. He was a year ahead of me. Oh, I don't know. His sister was in my class. That's it. Yes, and she introduced me to her brother. And I think shortly after that is when the sister invited me over to her home first, and I met this wonderful Carl Johnson.
Oh, I see. So it was through the sister that you met the father.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And up until this point, you had a basic instinct about injustice, but you had no developed political consciousness.
That's right.
Up to that
That's
point.
Right.
Were you involved in... you said your father was very active in Democratic politics. Were you involved in youth groups, your community groups, just the church group?
Just the church group. And my high school clubs, you know.
Mm-hmm. What church clubs were there?
Well, Spanish Club, El Círculo de Español, and one other academic club. What was it? I think it was a history club.
Mm-hmm. Now, up until the point, you met Kermit, and were you dating other boys out?
Nope, that was really my first boyfriend. I would date them to the extent of I would go to a game with one boy or go to a movie with one boy, another boy. But there was nothing, I just looked upon them as pals. I wasn't really interested. I was very late and mature as far as having a sexual interest in any of these kids. And I think that he was my first boyfriend. Isn't that something?
But tell me about your first reaction to his father when you first met him.
Well, I think that his father wanted to know more about me, and I told him what church I belonged to. And the first thing that we got discussing was the Bible. And he said, so you know, I went to Bible school, and I was a Sunday school teacher. In fact, I insist upon Kermit joining the choir in my church if he wanted to go with me, you know. So apparently at that time I had very strong ideas yet, and the father was so diplomatic, he would just challenge me, and he'd usually throw one little question up into my bonnet, you know. Well, what about this part of the Bible? And I was quite proficient in citing all of it, you know. And I'd go home and think about it, and it intrigued me, and I could hardly wait to get back and discuss it with him. And this was an ongoing thing, because it took me a long time to get over that Bible bit.
Well, were you a very intellectual child up until this point? Did you do a lot of reading and inquiry on your own?
All my reading was of the Bible, teaching the Bible, going to Bible classes, and other literature, normal literature assigned in school, and history. I loved early and ancient history. But outside
of
that,
you weren't a reader outside of that.
No, there was no access. I had no access to anything.
So this was almost your first contact with an intellectual figure as well.
And then one time, I think I was the one who found in the wastebasket a copy of the American Guardian put out by the Ameringer Brothers in Oklahoma, and I took it over to my father-in-law because he'd already had some socialist ideas or contacts in South Dakota. And he felt that in order to get a better society, one of the things you had to get out of a person's head was religion. And so I think that's why he was concentrating on me and the religious aspect to begin with. But I took the American Guardian over there, and then our discussions took a different turn. And as I say, there was much hostility on the part of Kermit's mother, because we would get out on this a very old house with an old screened-in front porch, get out on the porch and discuss. Kermit would be there as well, and sometimes his sister, the one who was in my grade, would be there, but she was more religious like her mother. She became a Baha'i, and she's a very prominent Baha'i now today. She would come out, but usually just the three of us. After all, Kermit was very fond of me at the time, and I thought that I was fond of him too. I mean, this is my first boyfriend. It was all a whole new experience, and I felt much more comfortable talking with a father. And sometimes Kermit used to get a little bored, you know. You have a girl come and talk to your father all the time. What the hell is this kind of deal, you know? So I must have been a very strange person to him to begin with. But the father was a tremendously fine person, and he knew how to carry you. He never insulted you, never insulted your intelligence. Carry you up to a certain point, and if you could see, I suppose, if you were getting apprehensive about something, just let it lay and you think it over, and then we'll come back again. Yeah?
Did he give you literature to read?
He didn't have any, I don't think. Now, wait a minute. From then, we went to the library, and then we got a discussion group going, because this was his whole interest at the time.
Now, this was still when you were in high school?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is still while we were in high school. Well, wait a minute. When did we get to know? I must have been out of high school, because then we ran away and got married. Mm-hmm. And oh boy, that was from that point on.
Well, let's go back a little before you got married. You said his mother was a spiritualist.
Mm-hmm.
You came out of a Methodist family. What was your reaction to her? Did you view her seem pretty strange?
Oh yes, I thought she was a pretty strange woman. I thought she was a weird woman. Because they went to seances, you know, and things like that. I went to one of them, and I don't see how people could even believe in any of it. And of course, she didn't like me very much, because she was one of these proselytizers. She wanted to get out and get people for her cause. Very strong-willed woman, and I was much in the father, who was the old term used to be henpecked, you know, inside of the house. Just seemed to be living when he was out on the porch talking about his ideas, because he thought she and her ideas were crazy as could be, too.
Now, he was an auto worker within the craft union.
Yes.
Did he talk about unions at all in your discussions?
That was something that was sort of taken for granted among Norwegians and Swedes. He was Norwegian, my father-in-law. And when many of them went into the car, he was a carpenter too, not by trade, mm-hmm. but just by natural training. And when they went into their work as carpenters, the carpenters union was already in existence, and it was a pretty a strong union. It was a good union for them. And so with him, unionism was just something that you took for granted. And many of the old Germans, his mother was Genevieve Hempling. She was a German extraction from South Dakota, and he was Norwegian. And these are the people that came from Europe and brought the ideas of unionism and cooperatives and things like that. So we already had an understanding of cooperatives and of unions. And it's sort of a beginning foundation of socialism, mm-hmm. sort of socialist ideas that would have, I think, probably come from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing specific.
And did Kermit himself, while you were still in high school, he and his friends have some of these ideas?
No.
Or your relationship, because it's a boy-girl relationship, and the father happens to be someone you wanted to talk to.
Yeah. Now, I hadn't known Kermit too long before we ran off and got married, so with Kermit, he was not interested in these things by nature. He had this this pull inside of his home where his mother wanted him to go, you know, along with the ideas of spiritualism and the father over here, and I think even he couldn't understand the ideas of his mother. He loved her very much, and they had a very, very close relationship. She adored the ground he walked on, but I think that his yeah. father made much more sense to him.
Well, once you started seeing him, you say that he and many of his friends became your friends in high school.
No, I became acquainted with him.
Mm.
I really didn't get into his circle, you know.
Mm.
I became acquainted with his friends, but we never went anywhere, did anything together.
Mm.
I guess it's because they were on the other side of town, and because I had such restrictions, I couldn't go out, you know, at night and during the week, but on weekends until 11. I had quite a few restrictions on me, which I observed because I wanted to keep some peace for my mother.
Well, how did your family react to your beginning to see this working class door?
I don't think they thought too much about it. They thought it was just a first boyfriend. But when I ran away and got married, then there was a reaction. It was a real good reaction. And from my father, of course, they were foreigners, because even though my father-in-law was born in South Dakota, you know, Norwegian. And
well, up to the point of your running away to get married, were things getting much worse at home for you with your father?
They were never good, yes. They were never good. They were intolerable at times. And as you grow older, you just can't take this kind of treatment, either on the part of yourself or your mother. And then after I ran away and I was out of the house, I remember trying to get my sisters to give my mother protection. And that didn't happen with my first sister, but the younger one, later on it did. And she didn't know how to handle it, and she got her tooth rammed through her mouth. But he was a man you couldn't show any fear of. If you saw just a glimmer of fear in your eye, you were sunk. And he never saw that in my eye. And he was sunk.
Tell me how you happened to decide to run away and get married then.
Well, I think, the primary thing was the conditions in the home. I just felt I had to break away. But the thing that triggered it was he had a friend in the band. Yes, he was in the band, who had been going with a girl. They called it going steady then. And one time when we were together, the four of us, they said they were going to Bowling Green, Ohio, which was a romantic spot to go get married in at that time, in that area of the country, to get married that weekend. And, of course, that was an exciting topic, and I was asking a million questions, because who would ever think of daring to do such a thing? So I said, well, how are you going to do it without your parents knowing? How are you going to go away and get married without your parents knowing you're going to do it? So they said that they were going to tell the parents that they were going to the game. The band had to go out of town, whether it was to Ann Arbor, wherever it was, and many of the kids would get on bus and come back in the evening. And instead of going to the game and his being in the band, they were going to Bowling Green, Ohio, and get married. And so they proposed that Kermit and I do the same thing. And I didn't have any ideas of it then. And so they called me and they said, what are you, chicken or coward or whatever they called me at the time? We dare you to do it. And I was joking around. I go, all right, I'll flip you or something like that. okay, we flipped the coin and I lost, and that was just I'm going with him to the trip. That meant Kermit had the line, so he was going to band practice. I had the line, so I was going to the game, and this was a new experience for me. So we went down to Bowling Green, Ohio. And when we were down there, they went in to get married. Again, the same thing. And we dared you to flip a coin. Boy, I'm telling you, I must have had two brains waiting for something else to join them. And so we got married. And I remember when the justice of the peace, it was in a little house with a little tiny stoop on the front, little step. And the justice of the peace said, aren't you going to kiss the bride? I took one, looked at him, walked out the door and sat on the step and put my hand in my, what the heck have I done, you know? Because marriage then was something entirely different. It was supposed to be for life, you know, a life sentence, like a judge sentencing you to your life, your eternal life, and so on. And I sat down on the steps, and I was just dumbstruck, and all the way home I was. And when I got in the house, they wanted to know about the game, and I suddenly became physically ill, sick to my stomach. And then I get up and go to school every day the next week, you know. And
up
something.
At this point, have you and he had any sexual relationships?
No. No.
So even you went back home and you both proceeded to live your lives in
a. Yes, the same as we did. Mm-hmm. And then he began to feel like he was a young man. He was married and he always did have difficulty keeping secrets too, I guess. His mother said something about me at home. And he popped out, you can't talk that way about my wife. And she said, what do you mean? Well, she had no trouble getting anything out of him. And the next thing I know, we were in school, and the mother came over to see my folks. And, oh, man, all hell broke loose then. And when my father took such a turn and locked me in the room, I crawled out the window. Naturally, what would you do if you were rebellious? And I called Kermit, and we decided, and I thought I was saving him from a trip to jail, this man act and so on, I didn't understand. So he said, you haven't consummated the marriage, my father said to me. So I said, we've got to go to a hotel right away. And that's the first time that I had sex. And I had him put a blanket up between, oh my goodness, that was a nightmare. Okay.
Were you both told me again?
Hmm?
Was he totally ignorant as well?
I never thought about that. I don't know. I don't think I ever thought about that, really. So that was the beginning of a pretty tough period of my life.
And before you actually ran away and got married, what had been your plan for yourself in terms of high school and college and your career? Did you have any plans?
Yeah, I was planning to go into college. I planned to go to the University of Michigan. And it wasn't an active thing. It was just sort of always taken for granted, you know. And schoolwork was not easy. It was not hard for me. It was very easy. In fact, when all of this happened in March, Kermit was going to graduate in June. And the remainder of that semester, he was in very big difficulties. He was not as disciplined in academic manners as I was. And I did his two big papers. And one of them was in physics, and the other was in another subject for him, his final papers for him to be able to graduate. And I remember even copying his writing. And he turned them in. I wrote the whole thing in his little jerky writing, and he got A's on both of his papers, and I hadn't even taken the subject. It's physics. I hadn't taken any of these 12th grade subjects. So he graduated, and then I think that's when my father said to me, you know, you've made your bed, you've got to lie in it. And that's when he went and tried to find a job in Ypsilanti.
But up till this point, once they found out you were married,
yeah.
Did you leave the home, or were you both living you remain in your own home still?
I think at the time he graduated, we were living in our own home. Because I know by then, after we'd had the big fight and the big powwow, and my mother came in as a peacemaker and everything else, broken heart. Oh, my father had a beautiful big photograph then running the society column of the paper. Like that, you know. And he wanted to make it all official and legal and everything else. Beautiful photograph he had put in there. And
did you think that you were in love with him?
Who, with Kermit? I think then I probably, yes, I think I was after, it was such a different kind of life too, you know, with his father, an intellectual life, and then Kermit became more interested. And it was the absence of domination. In fact, if anything, I would have been dominant. I was the dominant figure in our relationship. He was not as strong as I was. And he sort of counted on me, and that made for problems also. Counted on me to make decisions, and I just naturally stepped in and made them.
Now, after he graduated, then is when he went to Ypsilanti, and he took a job there. And that would have been his first job, in other words.
Yes, his first job. Mm-hmm.
And that was doing part because of general labor?
Yes, some kind of general labor work. And that's when he brought his paycheck home, and I didn't have a job, naturally. And I went out to buy the groceries and pay the rent. And I spent the money on groceries in half a week and told him to go back and ask his boss. I tell his boss this was ridiculous. People couldn't live on this kind of money. And that's when I first got my lesson that you just, you know, you had to live on
what wage labor meant.
What wage labor meant, yeah. Yeah, I had read it in books. I read Jacob Riis's How the Other Half Lives and a number of books, but you have to have the experience yourself. And I wired home frantically, called home or something frantically to my mother, send me money, mother. For heaven's sakes, he's got a boss that just doesn't understand anything. And my mother says, my dear, that's the system. And the second week, I didn't have much better luck, and I don't know what I did the third week. Mother sent me money a couple of weeks. And
did your father know she was sending you money?
No. Mm-hmm. No. And my mother protected my pride. I didn't want him to know.
What did Kermit's father think about the marriage?
Kermit's father was the most philosophical guy in the world. He thought that Kermit had gotten a very wonderful girl because he was fond of me. And he was very happy. I mean, he thought maybe we could have waited a little longer. And he was always in favor of as much education as a person could get. But his son, he couldn't afford at that time to send on to college. And so his son had married a very nice girl, and he was much more philosophical about the whole thing than the mother.
Now, when you came back from Ypsilanti, you lived in your own apartment, the two of you?
I don't know where we lived. We lived in some kind of a little rented place to begin with. Two or three of them, a couple of them, I guess. And I don't know. The automobile industry was very bad, and layoffs and so on. And finally, we moved back up on the third floor. My mother felt that I was going to have a baby then, that she would feel much better if I were renting from my father. And I had the idea that maybe being grown up and so on, maybe I could have some influence in keeping, you know, my two little sisters and the family a little happier if I were closer too. So that's where I was at the time of the strike, and that's where I was. I don't know how long I lived up there.
Oh, so you lived there for quite a long time.
Oh, yes.
Oh. Now, it was after you came back from Ypsilanti then that you became more involved with your father-in-law in the meeting and discussion group.
Yes.
And how did the group form? Where did the other people in the group come from?
They were factory workers, and I think Dad made the first contact with some factory workers, and then others. There was one who was had been around the SLP some other city or some other time of his life or something, and we got acquainted with him. Now, I think that we would have met most of these people right in the Pengelly building, because Fred Stevens was a union man from the transport workers, the transportation workers in Flint, the bus drivers. And Grover English was from Buick. So we probably, this is where workers that had any class consciousness at all would have, this is where they all just sort of migrated toward the center, the Pengelly building right in the center of Flint. And this is where we finally got our little room called the Socialist Party of America, you know, and put it on the door.
But the core of the group would have been people that would have been coming out of the building,
yes.
And then you opened up an office.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You see, they would come down there for union meetings and just sometimes come down to their union halls and talk. And there was a beer garden downstairs, but most of our people in the Socialist Party weren't beer drinkers. They might drop in to talk to other workers about a problem over one glass of beer or something.
How is it, at this point, when you started this group and the Socialist Party, we're talking about you, 19, 20 years old yet, really.
Mm-hmm.
How did they react to you as such a young and woman in the group? Do you recall?
How they reacted? I was much older for my age, for one thing, than a lot of people at this age. I mean, you think of a girl 18 or 19 now talking to auto workers or people in their 20s or 30s or 40s, and it doesn't have the same relationship. I was much older, and secondly, most everybody knew my family, and for whatever that was worth, they knew that, I don't know. I know. I do, too, know. Because they sort of looked at me as a person who'd come to these ideas out of choice.
Mm.
You know, that I had come from a family who was well enough to do, and so on. Out of choice. So, the men in the Socialist Party, I think that everybody accepted me. There might have been one exception. One of the Love Stone Nights, after she became sort of imbued with ideas of Love Stone Nights. She might have had a little resentment, but because I was one of the best informed. If we had assigned lessons, for instance, in Das Kapital or something like that, I read the assignment. I came back in, and I was always participating. And I, along with Dad Johnson, my father-in-law, I was one of the best informed.